Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. There's a word, free. Freedom of emotion, freedom of expression, free speech. For most of my career on the radio, on BAI and then Sirius Satellite Radio, and now here on PRN.FM, I've been concerned about and involved intimately with the ideas and the actualities of censorship and free speech. And this goes all the way back to protests in the 60s on college campuses and free speech movement, which started out in Berkeley, I think. These days, aided, of course, by like everything else is, you can't escape the whole idea of social networking, Facebook, emails, texting, and the internet, but so amplified by that. In the last decade or more, perhaps, and this has been building up for quite some time, it involves certain cultural trends and certain, you know, changes in politics and the way society works, most of them for the better, but sometimes things go too far in some directions. So the last decade or so or more, there's the issue of speech and certain behavior being considered literally hurtful, even dangerous, bullying, and the whole idea of hate speech laws. And a lot of these hate speech laws, and there are rules about them, and on campuses, college campuses, and again, the idea of bullying and racism. I mean, a lot of you may have heard about the incidents at the University of Missouri where the president and chancellor announced their resignations last month because of student protests over accusations of racist and hate speech on campus. This is just speech now, you understand, not actual physical attacks or discrimination against students, which is, you know, obviously a violation of the law. We're talking about speech. And we have a guest today who concentrates on this and spends her her career trying to deal with this. Her name is Samantha Harris, and she's the director of policy research for FIRE. FIRE is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how you doing?
Good, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. Recently, and I guess this is something maybe you're the author of, or maybe that this is under your authority at FIRE. You issued a report, and it's called Spotlight on Speech Codes 2016, The State of Free Speech on Our Nation's Campuses. And I want to talk to you about that a little bit. But I want, before we do that, I want to get a little background on you. You're a director of policy research at FIRE, but what did you do before that?
So I have been at FIRE for most of my career, but I am I'm an attorney. So I graduated from law school in 2002, and then I clerked for a federal judge and did a brief stint as a litigator at a firm before joining FIRE.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever come across, when you were clerking, any the cases involved issues of free speech or censorship?
Not in my particular clerkship, no. No, it was an area of interest. You know, the First Amendment and constitutional law generally was an area of interest of mine, both as an undergraduate and in law school. I was on the Journal of Constitutional Law.
Mm-hmm.
But no, most of the cases I dealt with in my clerkship were, you know, either criminal or, you know, various federal statutes.
Right. Then now, FIRE, how long has that been around, and what's its mission? What are the goals?
FIRE has been around since 1999, and our mission is to defend the individual rights of students and faculty on campus. So that's free speech, the right to due process, the right to what we call freedom of conscience, which is the right to be free from compelled speech. But free speech is one of our big focuses.
Mm-hmm. When you say compelled speech, what does that mean?
Well, so, you know, the Supreme Court case that best illustrates the right to freedom of conscience is the case in which the court held, it was called West Virginia State Board of Education v. Barnett, and the court held that a public school could not compel students who were Jehovah's Witnesses to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, I see.
At the beginning of class. So, you know, things, you know, compelled speech, it comes up on campus, you know, sometimes universities will try it as a form of penalty to require students to issue an apology for something,
mm-hmm.
You know, or faculty who might be required to sort of subscribe to some sort of litmus test or loyalty oath, you know, in order to teach on campus. So, it's a little bit, I mean, it's related to the right to free speech, you know, but it's the right to the freedom not to speak, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Not to be
speak, you know, when it's not in accordance with one's beliefs.
Would that include something like we'll get to the report in a little bit, but would that include something like refusing to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, stand and recite that? Because we all
right,
had to do
exactly,
that when I was
yes.
in school.
I mean, that's what, in fact, that was the Supreme Court case from the 40s that sort of really established the right to freedom of conscience, separate from the right to free speech. Was this case that involved? You know, Jehovah's Witnesses, for whom it was against their religious beliefs to stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
But the case was decided not on religious freedom grounds, but on, you know, this right to be free from government orthodoxy, essentially.
So the
compelled adherence to government orthodoxy.
And who was behind the founding of FIRE? I mean, who felt the need for it? Who joined together to do this?
So FIRE was co-founded by a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Alan Charles Kors, and a civil rights lawyer from Boston, Harvey Silverglate. And they felt compelled to do this for a variety of reasons. You know, Alan Kors was involved in a case on Penn's campus, which, you know, was pretty well known at the time. I don't know how well known it still is, but it was an incident where a student, an Orthodox Jewish student, was accused of racial harassment because he had shouted, water buffalo at a group of women who were making a lot of noise outside of his window during finals while he was trying to study. And, you know, after that case was in the news, Alan Kors started hearing from other students around the country who were finding themselves in similar predicaments, you know, facing punishment from universities for what would otherwise be protected speech.
Mm-hmm.
And then he and Harvey Silverglade, who was a longtime friend of his, you know, and an attorney, decided to write a book about this called The Shadow University. And after that book was published, they started hearing from yet more students and faculty around the country asking for their help. And that is what, you know, drove them to found FIRE.
And how's the organization funded?
Privately. I mean, it's through a combination of individual donors and foundations. I don't know the exact percentage that comes from individual donors versus private foundations, but it's all privately funded.
Okay, and so every year, the headline on this press release is restrictions on campus speech rights hit new low, but mm-hmm. federal pressure threatens progress. So, good news and bad news?
Right, yes.
And this is called Spotlight. This is something, obviously, you issue every year, right? Spotlight on speech codes?
Yes, so we have a database on our website called the Spotlight Database, and there we catalog restrictions on speech at, you know, a number of major colleges and universities across the country. We focus on public schools in particular because they're the ones that have the legal obligation under the First Amendment to uphold students' and faculty members' free speech rights.
Mm-hmm.
But we also include a sampling of, you know, the sort of most influential private universities as well, because a lot of private universities promise students and faculty the right to free speech. And then they have, you know, a moral and perhaps even a contractual obligation to uphold that right once they've promised it. So that database where we catalog those restrictions is called Spotlight, and it's, you know, intended as an educational tool, just the way, you know, someone might consult the U.S. News and World Report rankings. You know, we want students and their parents and, you know, perhaps faculty considering teaching at an institution to look up what the restrictions on speech are,
mm-hmm.
So that they know ahead of time. And so then every year we take the findings from our Spotlight database, the information we've collected in that academic year, and we publish this report on the overall state of free speech on campus.
So in your report for the 2016, I guess then that's for 2015. And
right, I mean, it's looking back at the 2014-2015 academic year.
Okay, it says here that for the eighth consecutive year, we have seen a decline in campus free speech codes, which by your lights is good. And the percentage of schools maintaining the most restrictive policies is now below 50%. Okay, that's good. That's,
yes.
But you say, while many universities have revised speech codes, an increasing number are adopting more restrictions on speech under pressure from the Department of Education. And you mm-hmm. say, these hard-fought gains for student and faculty speech rights could be reversed if the federal government is left unchecked. So that's a contradiction, right, in a way.
Well, yes. I mean, so overall, the number of speech codes has declined because, I mean, speech codes come in a variety of forms. I mean, first of all, with regard to harassment policies, which is where the Department of Education comes in, actual, you know, sexual and racial harassment are not protected speech. But what you, what
you mean,
we
you
see
mean action,
is that a
you mean actions. When you say sexual and racial harassment, does that mean actions or?
Well, it can include verbal conduct, but the Supreme Court has set out a very specific definition. So for verbal conduct or for any conduct to constitute unprotected discriminatory harassment, it has to be so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it effectively denies the victim the access to an educational opportunity or benefit. Because the reason that sexual and racial harassment are considered, you know, are regulated by the Department of Education under federal law is because they are considered forms of discrimination. So, you know, it has to create a hostile environment that actually amounts to discrimination against the person being harassed. And, you know, the federal government has the ultimate power to withdraw federal funds from institutions that are out of compliance with anti-discrimination laws. So what we see is that a lot of schools sort of go above and beyond and adopt harassment policies that prohibit speech that goes beyond what the Supreme Court has said is actually, you know, constitutionally unprotected harassment. Then in 2013, you had some the Department of Education entered into an agreement with the University of Montana. It was the resolution of an investigation into the university's compliance with Title IX. And Title IX is the federal law prohibiting sex discrimination, including sexual harassment, on campuses receiving federal funds. And federal funds includes anything. I mean, if you have students there on a Stanford loan, you receive federal funds. So it's not just public schools. It's the overwhelming, you know, there are a handful of schools nationwide that don't receive federal funds. So this applies to basically, you know, all of the essentially all of the country's colleges and universities. So in this resolution with the University of Montana, the Department of Education set out a very broad definition of sexual harassment, and it was one that, you know, is at odds with previous guidance from the department and with Supreme Court. They defined it as any unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature.
So,
and in that resolution agreement, they referred to it as a blueprint for colleges and universities throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've seen is that a lot of colleges and universities have adopted that broad definition following the 2013 resolution agreement.
As far as so when you describe what the Supreme Court said and the Department of Education, obviously they're expanding it and making it you know, more inclusive of almost anything. What, can you give me a solid example of what would constitute real sexual harassment? That something, I mean, would your group not represent somebody? Give me an example of something really, you know, I mean, which involves just speech, not action.
Well, I mean, what you have to think of is something that would essentially cause a reasonable person to take actions that would effectively prevent them from getting an education.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if someone was, you know, following someone around campus, you know, shouting slurs or sexual comments at them to the point where that person stopped going to class.
I see.
Didn't want to leave their dorm or even took a longer route to class every day, you know, ending up late because they were trying to avoid this person. I mean, you have to, there's a reasonable person standard in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to say, what would a reasonable person do in response to this conduct? And if a reasonable person's response to this conduct, because of the severe and offensive nature of the conduct, would be to, you know, withdraw from educational activities or withdraw from, you know, other institutional activities, then you're looking at something that's harassment. I mean, it's hard. The particular case in which the Supreme Court set out that standard involved both physical and verbal harassment.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, it's a little bit difficult to say exactly what would constitute pure speech that would be harassment, but it would be something. I mean, you can imagine something that might cause you to change your behavior in such a way that your education was really negatively impacted.
And
that's what we're talking about.
And this could
we're talking about a reasonable person.
All right, so this could
in the position of the victim.
This could include social network kind of maybe people piling on somebody in social network and to the point where they feel that they're unable to continue functioning at the campus, right? Something like that.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Department of Education, you say, has made this, has expanded all this, made it broader. How have they done that?
Well, they have and they haven't. I mean, they can't in the sense that Department of Education regulations don't trump the Constitution. So they don't actually have the authority to proscribe speech that's constitutionally protected.
Mm-hmm.
But schools are very afraid of, you know, being the target of an investigation and potentially an enforcement action from the Department of Education. And, you know, in the last 5 years or so, the Department of Education has dramatically stepped up the number of schools that it's investigating for Title IX violations. Now, most of these stem from cases, issues of sexual assault, which is obviously a separate
right.
issue and involves physical conduct. But in this particular resolution agreement with the University of Montana, the one that they referred to as a blueprint, they did set out this very broad definition of sexual harassment. And this was very widely publicized. And so we have seen, you know, in an effort sort of to adopt best practices or what have you, we have seen a lot of schools adopting that broad definition. Now, so far, that it has not outpaced the number of schools that have revised other speech codes, and we've still been
mm-hmm.
seeing that decline. But, you know, this uptick is of concern to us because for many years we've been seeing just this steady decline. So seeing this uptick in restrictive sexual harassment policies is something that was of concern to us.
Now, we're talking, you've been discussing individual cases here, and which would violate the college's, speech code, and then, punishment would come on the student. But does this also include, classes of students who are singled out by other groups of students, you know what I mean, on a larger issue?
Can you give me an example?
Well, for instance, if a fraternity at school, pick fraternities because usually they're the center of a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. If you pick a fraternity at school, a white fraternity goes out of their way to be insulting and only with speech, but insulting to a black sorority, right? Something like that. Mm-hmm. Sort of a double. I mean, so there are classes of people. Let's say, you're going all the way back to the integration of battles of the 50s, where, let's say, a group of black students who are, 1% of a campus. I don't know if that even exists anymore anyplace, but let's say that happens. And then, just generally the atmosphere is full of, speech that is hateful speech, right? Something like that. I mean, so it's not one particular person, but a group of people who are being picked on because of their color, because of their gender, because of their sexual preference, something like that. So it goes beyond individual bullying, and it's just sort of, one group against another smaller group.
I mean, in terms of what the university could do with regard to discipline, I mean, I think you have to look at, student organizations themselves can, be collectively disciplined, but, in terms of whether you would discipline every member of a fraternity for harassment because of an allegation that, members of the fraternity created a hostile environment, I mean, I think it's, when you're talking about the balancing of protected speech versus harassment, I think, in terms of individual punishment, you would need to look at the actions of individuals.
Mm-hmm. All right.
The idea of sort of collective punishment is troubling if you don't actually have evidence, that each person in that collective, partook of the conduct that's,
Mm-hmm. I understand. So as far as your report, what do you see as something that people have to watch out for? The college is going too far to self-censor because of the Department of Education. That's a problem, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, restrictive policies adopted in response to this guidance are a problem. And I think, it's difficult for people to understand. I mean, there was just, I'm not going to remember the school off the top of my head, but there was just an article the other day in which a college administrator was quoted as saying that, Title IX and the Title IX regulations trump the Constitution, which absolutely is not the case. I mean, mm-hmm. the government agency cannot lawfully pass regulations that would require a school to prohibit speech protected by the First Amendment, nor would the Department of Education say they have done that. I mean, they have, in fact, in the past clarified that their regulations don't require schools to prohibit protected speech. But schools are, I would say, desperate at this point to avoid investigation and possible enforcement actions. And so when the department issues guidance that contradicts what they've said in that regard, schools are still likely to take it very seriously and act. Because, the other thing is that while it is illegal, for example, for a public school to violate the First Amendment, the costs of a First Amendment lawsuit are often less than, the cost of, say, losing one's federal funding. I mean, typically, mm-hmm. there aren't a lot of damages in a suit for a violation of First Amendment rights. The remedy would typically be, even in a court of law, injunctive action, that preventing the university from enforcing that policy, possibly awarding, a small amount of damages or attorney's fees. But so, from a financial standpoint, the thumb on the scale is much heavier on the side of the cost of allowing speech to take place on campus that might lead someone to file, for example, a Title IX complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the law is clear, schools, I think, are still more likely to err on the side of caution when it comes to not wanting to run afoul of the Department of Education in any way. That makes sense.
It does. It does. And do you also defend faculty members who are singled out by the university for something they may have said in a class or something they may have published, right?
Yeah, we do. We do. And I would say that over the past few years, we've seen an uptick in the number of cases that involve classroom speech, and in fact, germane classroom speech. Germane means, you know, related to the topic of the course. Because there's no question that if a math professor, you know, goes off on some sort of political tangent, that would be not germane to the class. That doesn't mean it's not necessarily protected speech, but when speech is germane to the topic being taught, you know, there are much greater implications for academic freedom when that speech is censored. So, you know, we've seen a real uptick in the number of faculty who are coming to us because students have complained in the classroom about, you know, their treatment of controversial topics, essentially.
So when somebody comes to you, a student or a faculty member, you give legal advice and sometimes actually legal representation, file a lawsuit?
Not exactly, no. FIRE itself does not litigate, and we don't give legal advice. I mean, we operate sort of in what I would call the court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody comes to FIRE and they have a case that, you know, after our we have a very intensive review process, and if it's a case that we decide to get involved in, typically our involvement is writing a letter to the university and then possibly helping to publicize the case, because oftentimes when it comes to censorship, universities don't want to have to defend publicly what they try to do in private. So oftentimes, that kind of public exposure will resolve a case. We do refer students who want to litigate against their universities to outside attorneys, and we have a project right now where we have engaged a First Amendment lawyer to challenge speech codes in court, and we've helped students connect with that attorney and publicize the cases and work together with the attorney, but we ourselves do not litigate.
If this whole idea of bullying, and you read some of these tragic cases where somebody's bullied, where somebody, you know, commits suicide, a student commits suicide or something because they're bullied and humiliated in some way by social networking or whatever else the wonderful world of the internet and technology has provided for us, but just general bullying. I remember, you know, like I'm not of a newer generation, but there was all sorts of bullying that went on, and nothing much could be done about it. If you wanted to complain about it, you would get it even worse. I mean, and nothing. The idea, you know, when I was going to high school and college in the 50s and 60s was, if you can't take it, then just leave. You know, you really, you know, if the people in a fraternity or a football team or something were constantly bullying you or yelling at you, let's say you had a sexual different sexual preference, if you were homosexual or something like that, or you had a different political point of view. I mean, I remember during the Vietnam War, I set up, I was a member of Young Democrats, president of Young Democrats. So I set up I guess more liberal than, you know, the actual Democratic Party, set up a booth against the war. And the student leader of the ROTC came over, and he was a member of the football team, fraternity, the usual scenario, knocked over the table, tore up the leaflets, and called us all kinds of names, you know, commie, faggot, this, that, and everything else. Obviously, you know, destroying property is something you can complain about. But this whole idea of protecting people against being called names, hurtful names, what's called hate speech. I mean, what is your position on the general idea of hate speech? Because there was used to be no protection against it. Now there's protections all over the place.
Right. Well, I mean, let me back up for a minute and say that, you know, when it comes to bullying, when we look at the cases that have actually made the national media, you know, for example, the Tyler Clemente case, which I assume you're familiar with, that was kind of, you know, I mean, I think that was already 5 or 6 years ago now, but that really sort of brought bullying to the forefront of the national conversation. And if you look at that case, the conduct that was involved was already illegal. So when a lot of times when we hear schools talking about bullying and saying they want to adopt bullying policies, one of the things that we point out is that, you know, bullying itself is a vague term that, as you say, can encompass name-calling and it can encompass a lot of other conduct. And a lot of the conduct that schools want to prohibit under a bullying policy are actually already prohibited under existing and completely legitimate codes of conduct. I mean, there are laws against invasion of privacy. There are laws against, you know, videotaping people without their consent.
That was the case with Clemente. Yeah.
What?
That was the case.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the student who did that to him went to prison, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a lot of cases, and then again, you know, going back to that idea of harassment as conduct that's so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it really alters someone's educational environment, you know, even a lot of the verbal conduct that we associate with bullying is something that would rise to the level of harassment. So, you know, it's sort of, the terms bullying and hate speech get thrown around a lot, mm-hmm. But when schools enact policies banning simply bullying or hate speech without further definition, they're sort of adopting unnecessarily vague policies when a lot of the conduct, you know, the really truly serious conduct that they want to prohibit. Because as you say, I mean, there isn't a right to be protected from any and all hateful or offensive speech. I mean, mm-hmm. we all have to encounter things that are deeply troubling or unsettling to us.
Sure.
But there is a right to be protected against harassment, and I think that a lot of times, you know, these are not legal terms, but they're sort of terms that are in the popular media and in, you know, conversation, bullying, hate speech, and schools adopt these policies that sort of ban these vague things when in reality the conduct that really needs to be addressed they could get at through existing codes of conduct.
If I set up, let's say right now, on some university, and you say almost every college and university in the country, no matter what, receives some form of federal aid one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
If I set up on one of these campuses a table or a booth, let's say I'm a member of the KKK, and I just set up a table with leaflets and distribute them, and they are, to put it mildly, racially offensive. But they're not directed at any one person, and I just distribute this. Or if I set up, if I'm a member of the American Nazi Party, and I set up a booth, or if I, whatever, you know, a member of some group like that, and that's a university attempts to shut me down, that's something FIRE would get involved in, right? Or not?
Probably, but it's interesting because that is always the example. Everybody always asks us, well, what would you do if a student tried to start a branch of the, you know, a campus branch of the Klan?
Yeah.
And, it's a question that we answer, but it has never happened. We have never been contacted by somebody who has tried to set up a campus branch of the Klan. I mean, you know, luckily, I suppose you could say, most of the speech that we deal with that students find themselves disciplined for is much milder than that. That said, particularly when it comes to public universities, there are, you know, the Constitution prohibits viewpoint discrimination. So if someone is, I mean, you know, look, there was a case, you know, the Supreme Court upheld the right of the Westboro Baptist Church, which, you know, engages in what I think everyone would agree is the most hateful, offensive, awful speech imaginable,
mm-hmm.
upheld their right to picket at military funerals. I mean, the Constitution does prohibit discriminating against speech purely on the basis of viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone from the Klan or the American Nazi Party sought to peacefully distribute literature in a forum where people of all viewpoints were permitted to distribute literature, it would be unconstitutional to exclude that person from the forum simply because of the content, the viewpoint they are expressing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the minute that person's speech crossed over into urging people to take immediate violent action harassing Black or Jewish students on campus, that would be something the university could address. But, you know, even in the case of the most hateful speech, if someone is peacefully disseminating a message, we can't discriminate against that message simply on the basis of the viewpoint expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's important to remember that there were times in history where it was, you know, the abolitionists whose views were considered noxious, you know, the people advocating for gay rights, the people advocating for racial equality. So it's important to recognize that there are very good and valid reasons underlying the ban on viewpoint discrimination, because it's not always the sort of universally hated viewpoint that's considered controversial and that people are seeking to ban. I mean, that right protects us all.
Right. If you just tuned in, this is Mike Fader on The Turning Point, and we're talking to Samantha Harris, who's Director of Policy Research for FIRE, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And I have a couple more questions about some things that FIRE was involved in. And interesting article that appeared in the Times. But what is the website where people can get in touch with you if they have something to, where they need some help or they want to find out more about FIRE?
It is thefire.org. thefire.org.
You had a case recently, it says, about Colorado College, which is a private college.
Right.
Suspended a student for 2 years for a six-word joke on Yik Yak. Yik Yak is some kind of whatever, you know, social media. Somebody named Thaddeus Pryor, that's the name of the student, sent an anonymous reply to the comment at Black Women Matter on Yik Yak. Pryor's response read, "They matter, they're just not hot." Now, all right, so he posted that. And the Colorado College decided that his post violated its abusive behavior and disruption of college activities policies, and they suspended him for 2 years, right?
Yes.
So FIRE is getting involved in this, or has gotten involved.
Right. I mean, so FIRE wrote, and when we say getting involved, what I mean is what I was talking about before. FIRE wrote a letter to the college explaining why their actions were inconsistent with the commitments that Colorado College has made in its policies to free speech. And then when the college did not, rescind its suspension of him, we issued a press release and brought this to, the attention of the national media.
Mm-hmm.
And because, again, as you say, Colorado College is a private institution. Legally speaking, they can prohibit protected speech. Now, the question is, have they made commitments in their policies that might contractually obligate them to protect speech to the extent they've promised it? Perhaps. But the issue here is really that, they've promised one thing and they've delivered another, and that's something that, FIRE considers something that we want to bring to, the national attention.
Yeah, you said that, in this stuff I read on your website, you said Colorado College Student Guide said the Pathfinder provides that all members of the college community have such basic rights as freedom of speech. So obviously, one thing it said here was that Colorado College disciplinary action towards Pryor, this student, 21-month suspension for posting what was intended to be a joke. What if it wasn't intended to be a joke? Does it make any difference?
No, it doesn't. But I think that, it highlights the fact, as I said, that, most of the cases we deal with are not people who are truly, Klan members. I mean, this was an obviously ill-conceived and offensive joke.
Right.
But, the idea that his entire educational process should be disrupted over, an ill-conceived comment on social media, it is inconsistent with what the college seems to say about free speech. Because, there really isn't, if you protect free speech, that includes the right to offensive speech.
Well, yeah, that's been the what it's been for a long time, the Supreme Court cases, all the stuff about profanity, and was it Cone?
Cone v. California, yeah.
Yeah, where he was wearing a T-shirt.
And so, it's also important to note, people so often seem to think that if colleges don't take action, that there are going to be no repercussions to students for engaging in this kind of speech. But it's really important to remember that, in a society where we have free speech has very profound social implications. And it doesn't violate someone's right to free speech for them to be socially shunned for engaging in offensive speech. I mean, in fact, oftentimes those consequences can be the most powerful. The college is free to criticize a student, to even draw public attention to the fact that a student has said something like this. And any social consequences the student might face from his peers, are not a violation of his right to free speech. I mean, the right to free speech includes the right to respond to bad speech with more speech. And that's always what FIRE encourages people to do. So this idea that if there's not some sort of official institutional action, that students can just engage in, wildly offensive speech with no repercussions discounts the powerful impact that social repercussions have.
And actually what it would do is it would tend to suppress what would be a natural way of working things out, perhaps, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's interesting. I spoke shortly after the incident at their acronym is OU, but, where the fraternity members were videotaped engaging in a racist chant on the bus, and the president expelled them. Do you remember that case?
I remember reading about it, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, shortly after that, I was speaking on a panel at the University of Tulsa with the head of the Oklahoma ACLU. And he made the point, and I thought it was a great point, and I've sort of reiterated it since then. He made the point that in expelling those students, which at a public university really was probably a violation of their First Amendment rights, but by expelling those students, the president of the university actually shielded them from some of the most powerful consequences of their speech, which would have been after having this video go viral, after being the object of national hatred. They would have had to make the choice. Okay, do I go to class tomorrow? Can I face everyone? Am I going to sit down next to my African-American, you know, peers? Or am I going to have to leave in shame? And by expelling them, you know, he shielded them from those social consequences. And I thought that was actually a really good point.
No, it is a good point. I mean, I think the government and the authorities of any place should only step in if it becomes extremely disruptive and dangerous to a student's ability to continue at all.
There was
an article in the Times the other day, real quick. I know your time is, busy. An article said student protesters are self-absorbed and narcissistic, Oklahoma College president says. And it was the president of an evangelical college, obviously a private college.
I read that. It's not a daycare, it's a university.
Well, yeah, he's jumped into the latest campus culture awards with a complaint about a student who said he felt victimized by a sermon on love and should not have had to listen to it. He went to him, and it was a chapel homily based on Corinthians, right out of the Bible, right? And he said he went and he complained because it made him feel bad for not showing love. And the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, Mr. Piper, said in his mind the speaker was wrong for he mentioned that in his mind, that is, the student, the speaker was wrong for making him, the student, and his peers feel uncomfortable. And then he said, this is not right. This is not a daycare center. This is, and he said the university setting was not meant to be a safe place, but rather a place to learn that life isn't about you, but about others. And he went on and on and on. And he said, if you want to be enabled rather than confronted, there are many universities across the land, and he mentioned Missouri, right, that will give you exactly what you want. And he said, and then he called this a kind of, what we're seeing here, and this is the last thing I'll read from it, in our culture today is the end result of a politically correct agenda that has bred what I will call ideological fascism rather than intellectual freedom. I mean, you know, it's an interesting article here. And
it was bold of him to do that. But I think that, you know, a lot of times, I mean, one of the things that we've pointed out is that obviously, you know, there have been protests at a lot of schools. At a lot of schools, you know, the things that the protesters have demanded have had nothing to do with, free speech. Mm-hmm. But at other schools, there have been demands for, you know, specific people to resign, such as at Yale. There have been demands for, new reporting systems so that students can anonymously report faculty for any perceived microaggressions. There have been, calls for bans on hate speech. What FIRE has pointed out is that students are perfectly free. Their right to free speech protects their right to call for anything they want, including censorship. The issue is that so many administrators are so quick to give in to student demands, even when the student demands involve censorship. So, you know, you kind of had to hand it to this guy for standing up and saying, no, listen, like, that's not what this university is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know what his motives are, but I can understand why he got so angry about this. I mean, there have been a lot of, counter protests at various universities about things like, there was one university that issued a rule or I don't know if it was a suggestion or a rule that around Halloween, do you remember that? That were forbidding students.
Was it at Wesleyan? I think they did. I mean, a lot of universities issue Halloween guidance.
Yeah, you can't wear costumes that would be racially discriminatory or Indian headdresses, things like that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah. Now a lot of the times it's guidance about sort of cultural appropriation.
Yeah.
What you should and shouldn't wear. And look, I mean, universities are it's fine for universities to make these recommendations. The problem, and this kind of goes back to what's in our report, is that, you know, I wrote a blog for FIRE about that that Wesleyan case. And the problem is that Wesleyan has speech codes that potentially regulate that kind of expression, you know, expression that is, you know, certainly not unprotected, but that offends someone else on campus.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is that when you have sort of quote-unquote guidance from a university that's actually backed up by speech codes that could potentially, you know, land a student in disciplinary action for engaging in that kind of speech, then you have sort of a chilling effect on free speech on campus. I mean, university has free speech rights, too. It's free to suggest that students, you know, don't wear offensive costumes. It's free to kind of try to share its values with students and encourage students to share in those values. But it's not free to do, to the extent that it's either a public university or a private university that claims to be committed in any way to free speech or academic freedom, is try to impose through force and through threat of discipline its own values on students.
One last thing. You say Colorado College is private and not legally bound by the First Amendment. Why? How is any place in this country not legally bound by the First Amendment?
Because the First Amendment actually only regulates government action. I mean, obviously the text of the First Amendment is Congress shall make no law, but through a series of Supreme Court and court decisions over the years that established something called incorporation, the Bill of Rights was extended to apply to state government entities as well. So, you know, agencies of the federal and state government are not allowed to restrict speech under the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So public state universities are considered instrumentalities of state government that have a legal obligation to uphold First Amendment rights. The First Amendment does not apply. I mean, you know, Colorado College is not a government actor. It's not, does not have a First Amendment obligation to protect free speech rights, just as, you know, my private employer doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But at a public, at a state university, you know, students and faculty do have First Amendment rights.
All right. Listen, I guess I've covered most of what I wanted to ask you, and it's important that your organization is there and exercising its right to free speech and helping other people have you know, their free speech protected. It's thefire.org.
Yep.
Okay, thefire.org. And my guest has been Samantha Harris, Director of Policy Research for FIRE. And good luck with it. Thank you very much for doing what you're doing.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
We'll take a little short break here, and we'll be back. So there you have it, hate speech. I mean, there is nothing in the world that, moderation in all things, there is nothing that cannot be carried too far, right? What is politically correct? I mean, when I worked at BAI, many of you know what BAI is and have listened to me on BAI, BAI being part of the Pacifica Foundation. Used to pride itself on calling itself free speech radio. But of course, you could be censored, not officially censored sometimes, but occasionally the program director would officially call you in his office and just to suggest to you that you shouldn't say certain things on the air. There are groups that once were considered and still are oppressed minorities in this society. And have suffered tremendous discrimination, harm, terror, and have suffered through terrible misery. I mean, racially, sexual preference, gender. I mean, you name it, right? And it still goes on all the time in this country. It still goes on all the time. And the government needs to step in, or authorities need to step in. But there is such a thing, I think, as carrying things too far. I mean, anything is subject to being carried too far. I mean, politically correct is a kind of chilling effect by itself. So, for instance, on WBAI, several times in my career there, if I said something that was considered to be offensive or not even sensitive, let's say, put it this way, I would never say anything really offensive, but if it wasn't sensitive enough to traditionally or historically a harassed group, I was immediately charged with some sort of violation of some large class or some group's rights, and I was painted a certain way. But to the credit of the administration at a place like WBAI, at least at the time I was there, they never really fired anybody that I know of, except one time they did ban somebody for behaving a certain way inside the station. It didn't go out over the air. There was a broadcaster there who was originally, he wasn't from the South, but he had what you might call Southern attitudes. And I guess part of his life was spent down South. And he had, he uttered a comment about somebody there who was black. And this was in the hallway, right? And he was told that he was no longer welcome at the station. I mean, he'd get something like a 4-month suspension. And the same thing happened to me once. I went a little too far on the air and criticizing somebody about something I thought was offensive that they kept saying on the air all the time. And I was warned that if I kept doing that, that it would be, and this person happened to be black. And I was warned that I was generally considered around the station by a certain group of people to be a racist because I was, focusing in on one or two people who I consider to be anti-Semitic. I mean, it goes back and forth. But the I think what my guest said earlier is what should always be the case unless somebody is really being, and their life is just being ruined or it's so offensive that it's just too oppressive to bear, is that the antidote for vulgar or offensive or insensitive speech is other speech. Is to hold these people up, the people who are being insensitive or vulgar or offensive, to hold them up to ridicule. That is the way to oppose that. It's like Martin Luther King saying, and he's not the first one that ever said it, you can't fight hate with violence or more hate. The only way to dispel hate is through love. And the less that the authorities can get involved in something, unless they absolutely have to, like school integration in the 50s and protecting women, federal laws protecting women and sexual, and laws protecting people who are being picked out because of sexual preference. Sometimes the government has to get involved, and clearly, things are just out of control. But past a certain point, people have to bear the fact that other people may not like them or may be vulgar or stupid and insensitive. And that's the way life is. All right, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week. This is Mike Fader with The Turning Point. And I have a new, not a new website, but a redesigned website. So if you go to faderfiles.com online, you will see the beginnings of a new website. There are still things that have to be tweaked, but you might want to check it out. Thanks.
If you walk through the garden, watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon for the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have have to worry. If you hold on to Jesus' hand, you'll all be saved from Satan. When you're on the road, you gotta keep the devil. About you.